So my lecture today is supposed to address questions like, what does 80% crystallinity mean? Eventually, I'm not going to get there today, but this was a real common thing for people to ask, what's the degree of crystallinity of my fabric or my cotton here, and how is that related to its performance or dyeability? What separates elementary fibrils? We used to talk about elementary fibrils and microfibrils, and no one really knew what the difference between them was, except the elementary ones were smaller than the micro ones. And of course, we're worrying about water. Where is there room for water molecules in a cotton fiber? Is there room between the elementary fibrils and things like that? And basically, I got into this especially so to try and learn whether computer models are realistic enough. So I'm going to talk about diffraction by cotton fibers and then compare cotton crystals to real crystals or ideal crystals that you might want to use. And we're going to look at computer models of cellulose crystals and several that we've made and then look at some sample calculated diffraction patterns from these computer models and have a few conclusions. So cotton fibers consist mostly of cellulose and crystallites that are thought to be about 70 angstroms in cross-section, and or 7 nanometers. And these crystallites are arranged at angles to the cotton fiber axis, as we'll see in the next slide or so. And the samples are usually made either as fiber bundles or as a powder that's chopped up cotton fibers that you run through a Wiley mill and have something that looks like a powder. And you can use X-rays from a laboratory generator or a synchrotron if you're doing big science. And you can do electron diffraction with a transmission electron microscope, for example, or you can do neutron diffraction using a nuclear reactor to generate a radiation that you can get diffraction patterns with. And all of this applies to any of those different techniques. So this is Bill Goins' montage of electron micrographs that has been put together with cut and paste methods, and it's not at all a realistic picture. But what I want to show here is that the cellulose is, there's a primary wall here that's got quite a bit of low crystallinity cellulose in it. And then the secondary wall is all this material here that has a lot of little fibrils, microfibrils here that consist of the crystalline entities. And you'll notice that these are at quite an angle to the fiber axis, and then as you go toward the lumen here, they progressively tilt till they're almost parallel with the fiber axis. And so that's kind of an idea of the crystallinity in cellulose. This is still a little controversial. Anyway, if you have bundle of crystallites that are all arranged parallel to each other. Each one of these blocks here is a crystallite, supposed to be, and they're aligned this way with each other, but they have a rotational orientation variation here. And you shine a beam of X-rays at that, you'll get what's called a single crystal rotation pattern or a fiber pattern. And this is fairly easy to deal with and provides a lot of information. If you have a powder where you cut, now there's an error in this drawing, which by the way is from a book chapter by Chandrasekaran at Purdue University. If you have the fiber crystallites all cut up into pieces and arranged in a powder form in all sorts of random orientations here, then the diffraction pattern you get is a bunch of circles. And if you have a powder diffractometer, what you might do is just scan across this line, right, a line like this, and watch the bumps in optical density. If you collected this pattern on a film or if you use a counter, you might just look at this data because it's the same all the way around and it doesn't really make any difference. You don't get any more information by collecting this if the sample was truly in a random orientation. If you have partial orientation, like this scenario here, then the diffraction pattern will consist of arcs. And the spots will all be in the same positions, In any three of these, if the crystalline material is the same, but the orientation determines where the spots will fall on a film in terms of arcs or circles or spots. And the distance of these spots or arcs or circles from the main beam center depends on the dimensions of the repeated unit in the structure, and that's, crystallographers call that the unit cell. And the positions of these peaks are in reciprocal space. So a big space on a diffraction pattern corresponds to a small space in the real crystal. And the intensity of the spot or the arc or the circle depends on the arrangement of atoms inside the unit cell. That's both the molecular structure itself and the packing of the molecules in the unit cell. And then the breadth of the line or spot depends on the inverse of the crystal size and on the extent of paracrystallinity. So if you have small crystals, you get broad lines. If you have something that's high paracrystallinity, or that means low crystallinity, then you'll have broad lines and vice versa. So this is a real diffraction pattern of a cotton fiber bundle here. And you see that it's got these long arcs here, and I've called that partial orientation, and that's because of those different orientations of those microfibrils in the cotton fiber that Bill Goines drew up. If you just take a fragment of that secondary wall where the microfibrils were parallel to each other in the electron microscope, then you see that the arcs are much shorter, and this is the single crystal diffraction, single crystal rotation type pattern of a fiber pattern that you can get. It's the same material. If you look at this spot here and this spot here, those two spots close together, and then this more intense spot here, those correspond exactly to these two spots here, and this larger spot here. So it shows that the patterns depend on the form of the sample. And this is equivalent to a trace that you might make if you had a bunch of circles and went through the circles. You'd get bumps here, and here, and those are those three bumps here, and here, which are the most intense on the pattern. Okay, so we collected some experimental data for this work as well as the theoretical data, and we started with some fabric and scoured and bleached it, Wiley milled it to 20 mesh, refluxed it at 2.5 normal hydrochloric acid for 40 minutes, put it on a powder diffractometer, and this work was done by Alicia Josepha, of Professor John Wiley's group in the Department of Chemistry at UNO, in the University of New Orleans. And this is what the sample looks like in the scanning electron microscope, according to Bruce Ingber's fine work here. You can see that we haven't lost the fiber structure here, we just have pieces of it. So the fiber's been broken up, but there are little fragments here and there, to be sure, but basically you still have something, pieces that resemble a fiber here, but we've gotten rid of a lot of the amorphous material. And the black line and the green line here correspond to two different methods of collecting the experimental data. The green line is from a pressed pellet, which puts a lot of the cellulose close to each other, gets rid of the air, and gives you a high density sample, but it also tends to orient the fibers a little bit more when you squash them down like that. So one thing that's kind of interesting here is that you see that this peak here that showed up in a loosely packed sample here doesn't show up in the pressed pellet. The red line is a simulated diffraction line, or theoretical line, from the published crystal of cellulose that's was actually published. One of the co-authors was the first author on this paper, Yoshi Nishiyama. And you just put this into a standard crystallographic program, and it assumes that it's an infinitely large array of atoms regularly spaced, and you see the theoretical pattern matches the observed pretty well. There's a little discrepancy here in the spacing, and I'm not sure, I haven't tracked that down yet, but basically this is considered to be pretty good agreement here. You notice how much higher the space is here. This is of indication of an of amorphous material. The peaks are sharper here because it's an infinite array, although they've been broadened by the Platon program anyway, as much as I could. But anyway, this is assuming that the crystal goes on forever. Okay, well, a cotton crystal versus an ideal cellulose crystal. Here's what I've titled this slide. And the cotton crystallites are thought to be about 7 nanometers. If you had what you wanted, you'd have something about 200,000 nanometers in size. And this 7 nanometer crystal is only big enough to hold about 81 molecules, a 9 molecule by 9 molecule array, versus 6.6 times 10 to the 10th power molecules if you were dealing with an ideal size for a crystallographic study. So if you take those 81 molecules and look at it, go around the surface, there are 32 of those molecules around the surface, and you'd have about 1 million molecules on the surface of the ideal crystal. But for the cotton crystal, about 39% of the molecules are on the surface, and that means that the outer parts of those molecules are not held in place by any neighbors, and so they can be misaligned and so forth to a substantial degree. Whereas in our ideal sample, we'd only have 0.0016% of the molecules on the surface. So,
please give an example of 100% crystalline cellulose.
Yes, I'll show you one. If you want to calculate the intensity of a spot for an ideal for a periodic array, the standard diffraction equation is listed here, and it just depends on the coordinates of the atoms and the Miller indices H, K, and L here, and then the intensity is equal to this structure factor squared. And the problem is that cellulose crystals are not very close to the approximation of infinitely periodic arrays. Even though that pattern that I just showed you, the calculated and experimental, were pretty close in agreement. And the computer models of cellulose lose their periodicity when subjected to energy minimization. Let's see if I can go back to that. Come on. There. When you have a computer model and try to minimize the energy of that or subject it to molecular dynamics. So this is a computer model. It has 19 chains, 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 4 plus 3. And it was optimized so that if we put more chains out here, they wouldn't have as many neighbors with each other. And so we were trying to be efficient in terms of how many molecules we included in the model, because each one adds to the computer time required. This is the unit cell, as it shows that this chain is just like this chain, and the distance between the chains is this, and then this one is the next. And here, this is the A-axis of the unit cell here, or this one here, so forth, the gamma monoclinic angle. So this is the perfect crystal pole. And this is looking at it from the side. It's just 8 glucose residues long here because, again, that's our computer model. The computer time is expensive for doing these studies. And each glucose unit is a different color here. And you see that the chains, these three chains, are shifted a little bit more to the right than these two chains. But that's a plausible model for a small cellulose crystal. And after you do molecular dynamics for 10 nanoseconds, which doesn't sound very long, you see how messed up it is. We've gotten rid of the hydrogens here. But these outer chains, especially in this region and over on this side, they've been fuzzed up quite a bit looking down the long molecular axis. Inside, they're not quite so messed up. So you can imagine that if they're buried deep in an ideal crystal, they're not going to be messed up at all. But in the terms of cotton, this could be what the molecules look like. And this is a little bigger model here. Again, we've trimmed it here on the top and the bottom to avoid chains that don't have as many near neighbors as possible. But we've put 37 chains in this model. and still it's fuzzed up on the edges here. And this was just with energy minimization instead of molecular dynamics. Well, to deal with something like that, we've used this typical scattering equation that Debye wrote. Again, I'm not going to explain it, but it's there. We got a program for doing that by downloading it from the internet, written by Marcin Wodzior. And it's a very nice program, works very quickly. And also, the first author of this paper, Nishiyama, wrote a new program specifically for that, for this work. And the Debye program that we got from the internet, it's very quick. In a minute or something like that, you get a result based only on distances between the atoms and calculates only powder patterns. So anything with the same spacing from the main beam is going to be superimposed. And it looked like something like this. Now, these are some smaller models. A seven-chain model, which just has the central molecules of the unit cell and a couple more, and a 19-chain model. And you see, against the experimental line, which is in black here, the green line doesn't really bear much resemblance at all, where the red line is starting to show some signs of looking something like the cellulose diffraction pattern, but it isn't really very good. Now we go to our 37-chain model, and you can see it's starting to come in now as something as a plausible solution. I'll explain this problem here in a little bit. The original model in red matches up better in terms of the positions of the peak than after minimization, and this is clearly a deficiency in the modeling software. Where the peaks, the model molecules want to actually get closer together to each other than the real crystal shows them to be. Okay, the Nishiyama program uses that first equation I showed you for calculating the intensities, but for an infinitely large crystal, and we can take the diffraction space, reciprocal space apart and look at any part of it, and we can put the different parts together and create powder patterns or fiber patterns or whatever with this thing. And here's another ideal crystal here, Paul. This is a 7x7 chain array that's got 20 glucose residues long, and then after we minimized it with the amber glycam program, you see it's looks pretty uniform, but it's got a twist in it. And if we look at the calculated diffraction pattern now from the unminimized structure here, again, here's our crystal, and we essentially have rotated it around this long axis here to produce this pattern, which is just like a simulated fiber diffraction pattern. Here are the two spots that I pointed out first, and then the third one shows up here. What's maybe more interesting here is this low-angle scattering curve that shows up here, and there's some here, and we haven't got a real good handle on how to get rid of that, because those are the spots that are especially these right here that are showing up at low angles that are looking very different from the experiment. Going back to the minimized model now of this 49-chain structure, what we did was I took a slice at the third layer of molecule of glucose residues from the top of the model and the second from the bottom, so these weren't out on the ends exactly, and found that there was a 16-degree difference between these two planes. And so each glucose residue was twisted about a degree. There's about a degree of twist in the overall crystal from that energy minimization process. And again, I've got a little problem here that I haven't sorted out. Yoshi tells me that my experimental pattern is right on, and I may have made a mistake when I converted his measurements into the degrees to theta that go along this axis here. But you see, the original model now really conforms very well to the experimental curve, and this is the pressed pellet curve, by the way. So in this region here, we've got a little bit of calculated intensity where the experimental curve is quite smooth. But after that twist, you see that the intensity is very substantially reduced. Okay, I'll go back here. And so my friends that say that their models are correct and that cellulose crystals are twisted are probably not correct, because the diffraction pattern has been so reduced just by that, mostly just the twisting in the pattern. So that's something that we've gotten out of this that's pretty nice information, I think. So the results, we can readily see problems when the crystals are much too small. And I guess I should go back here one more time and show that the experimental curve has a much narrower line width. So even our 7x7 model is too small. And we've got another one coming with a 9x9 model that we think will narrow this peak here so it matches the experiment better. But when there's 7 or 19 chains, they're clearly wrong. And also we can tell the difference of the shape of the model crystal, because the biggest model we had was a almost square in cross section versus that hexagonal model that I showed you early. And the 49 chain model looks a lot like the experimental one, but the peaks are broader. The intensities are strongly reduced by twisting and because of the energy minimization, but the peak widths are not. So that was kind of an interesting finding, that that we're still able to pick up on the crystallite size because the peak widths are proportional to the crystallite size. So in conclusion, I'd just like to say that the experimental and simulated diffraction patterns from non-periodic structures should have many uses in understanding practical cellulose crystal structures, and we're just getting started with this. And we need bigger crystals to account for the narrow experimental line widths than what we have, which are bigger than what we used to think of them being. And the challenges include need for improved potential energy functions for the models, need for more complete environment for the models to avoid the low-angle scattering, as well as a way to solve the problem of preferred orientation in the experimental samples. Thank you. Any questions?
Beyond my imagination.
The result you have with intensities being affected by what you term as twisting, that if the width's not, could you explain a little carefully what that means in terms of twisting of the cellulose strands?
Okay, well,
the crystallite.
It's the crystallite itself that is twisted by the molecular modeling process. In other words, if we take the published crystal X, Y, and Z coordinates of the atoms in cellulose, which assume that you have an infinite array that each thing is like the next, and they're all parallel, there's no twisting at all in that, we can just tell to reproduce that unit cell and create the perfect crystal models that I showed. And then we say, well, people aren't going to study that. They're going to want to put them in a computer modeling program and do molecular dynamics,
right,
so that there's a motion there that's more realistic. And what we found is that we can find the flaws in the modeling software by just doing energy minimization. Because either with the molecular dynamics or with the energy minimization, that perfect crystal twists. Not very much, just 1 degree per glucose unit. But that's enough to clobber the intensities that you see.
Well, did you remove the hydrogen bonding during
the process? No, we didn't do, I mean, the computer program says, I see a hydroxyl hydrogen here and an oxygen over here, and I'm 2 angstroms apart between the hydrogen and the acceptor oxygen, So I'm going to lower the energy by that amount. If something forces it apart, that's not anything that I did. But they're mostly still there. In the molecular dynamics on the surface, you lose a lot of the hydrogen bonding that you started with.
And so it seems like you're pretty close to having good agreement between molecular modeling and the actual cellulose itself.
Well, we're good if we don't go through the energy minimization. But what I'm saying is that the intensity of those peaks drops way down. We don't think that it should have dropped
down.
What
does that represent, though, in terms of deviation from reality? In other words,
okay, how big a deal is 1 degree?
It's not a very big deal in my mind.
Yeah, okay. Well, see, if you look at how far apart the catalytic domain and the cellulose binding domain are in the cellulobile hydrolase, they're 15 glucose residues apart or something. I forgot what the right number is. But anyway, now they're off at different angles from each other.
Right.
And that isn't right.
And how close are you taking these unit cells and these crystallites and assembling them into modeling on a microfibrillar?
It's all a matter of computer time. Work that my colleague John Brady is doing, and he's insisting that these things are twisted. He's used up the supercomputer at the University of California, San Diego, and is now using Oak Ridge's. There's something like 700,000 atoms in his structure, which includes water and a protein molecule and an enzyme. But that's bringing these systems to their knees. Biggest computers that you can envision getting at right now. And so our little computational cluster in SRRC is probably not going to be modeling something that's too big, but we can look at these things at least on, I mean, these are reasonably small models that I've been showing. They're well within our grasp to do that size of a segment. I think Brady's doing more.